Raygun helps thousands of customer-centric software teams detect, diagnose, and resolve performance issues faster and more efficiently. And now, for a limited time, if you switch your application monitoring to Raygun, you will receive up to 20,000 in free usage credit. That's 20,000 US dollars. It's never been a better time to make the switch, save thousands, and empower your team with the visibility and insights they need to deliver a flawless customer experience. Visit raygun.com/switch to apply today for $20,000 in free credit. That's www.raygun.com/switch. This is Scott Hanselm, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm pleased to be talking with Dr. Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University and a leading expert on modern monetary theory, as well as a former chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and the author of the new book, The Deficit Myth. What an amazing opportunity to speak with you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
I've done all of the research that I can as a lay person. And, you know, I was trying to think about how I felt about this book and its place. And I realized that the last time I felt like this was when I read A Brief History of Time and became an internationally renowned expert in superstring theory. It was a time when, you know, someone wrote a book on particle physics and things, and they presented it to the lay person. And we all went and we read Stephen Hawking's book and we Googled our way to glory and we decided, wow, I'm an expert now. I know everything about this. No one had ever presented something so heady and so unattainable to the layperson. And we were all obsessed with this. And then, of course, Google, you know, turns us all into people who speak with authority. I think that's a funny parallel, though, to say that this is how it made me feel. But it blew my mind like that book blew my mind. And I wonder how you feel about that, bringing this heady topic to the masses?
Well, I mean, I feel enormously grateful that you would even think to put me in that category. I remember reading that book many, many years ago and sharing in the kind of way that you felt. And, you know, what a wonderful thing that Professor Hawking did, trying to communicate to kind of regular people, as you say, about a topic that is heady, and that he would want to break it down and make it as accessible as he could, is exactly what I aspired to. It's incredible company to even have you put me in a sentence with that sort of achievement.
Well, the thing that I find interesting about it, though, is that as I look back on that book, and now I'm looking back after the last week of reading this one, is how do I know if these things are true? And I'm curious, we see so many people arguing about economics. We see, I've read all the reviews, both good and bad, both political and apolitical, about the book. And why is economics a thing that is argued about when things like physics or gravity are less argued about? Is this a science or is this an art?
Well, most economists would probably tell you that economics is a discipline that enjoys a high degree of scientific rigor. We like to fashion ourselves, I think. When I say we, I mean I'm speaking for the discipline writ large, that economists do kind of fashion themselves as being, in a sense, on par with the hard sciences, with physicists and the like. And, you know, this belief that you can model the economy in ways that we can model the galaxy, you know, that there are certainties, there are laws that we can uncover, these fundamental laws like the law of gravity. I don't happen to believe that. I would personally think of economics as a social science. And while there are things that we do try to model, I think that, you know, economists could do with a good dose of humility in terms of, you know, what we know and recognizing the limitations of that knowledge. So that's kind of where I am.
I realize that we haven't talked about the definition yet, but I still want to poke at this to understand, are things in economics and this theory provable with more scientific rigor or with the lens of history looking backward?
Well, I guess it depends which arguments we are attempting to stress test or to prove or disprove, right? There are certain ways that economists attempt to explain consumer spending, for example, and we theorize that as income increases, consumption increases. I mean, this is something, you know, that's found in John Maynard Keynes's most popular and well-known book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And Keynes said, you know, there's a way to understand how households behave, how the consumer behaves. And we sort of know that when their income goes up, they tend to spend more and they save a bit more, but they also spend more. And so we can come up with estimates of how much additional consumption spending someone will do if their income increases by, say, $1. And we can go and we can look empirically at the relationship over time between household income and consumption. And we can see if they move in the ways that we theorize. That's something, you know, you can look back with the evidence of, you know, hindsight and some data. Mm-hmm. You can evaluate that theory. But then there are other things that aren't really theoretical. And some of those are found in MMT. So, for example, when I explain in the book that a government deficit is always mirrored to the penny by a non-government surplus, that the government's financial deficit appears in equal and opposite form as a financial surplus on the other side of the ledger, that mm-hmm. is something we can see. I mean, we can say that's either a correct statement or an incorrect statement. And I think because that really is following the laws of accounting, that's something that one does not disprove.
I see. So there are factual things. Gravity works thusly. These numbers are these numbers. You can feel that they're not true or not, but the fact is the ledger looks like this. And it is on that base that you build the more social theories.
Right. And so a proposition that's very common in economics is this idea that government deficits force interest rates to go higher. And that when interest rates go higher, that results in businesses borrowing and spending less. And so government deficits, we say, crowd out private investment. Well, you can go and you can look. You can look at different countries. You can look at what's happened to the size of the government deficit over time. You can look at where interest rates have gone subsequently. You can look at how private investment behaved. And you can test that theory against the empirical evidence, and you can find out whether there is any good support for that theoretical proposition or whether it's in fact imperfect or even wrong.
Mm-hmm. So the book, The Deficit Myth, has been described in a number of ways online. And one of the ones that struck me was it said, modern monetary theory is a heterodox macroeconomic theory, and heterodox is unorthodoxy. It's the opposite of orthodox. It's the opposite of convention. And it was described as being dissident. Is this a heretical thing, or is it just an unusual way of looking that people are just not willing to turn their heads in a different direction?
Well, I think it does. You know, it does take issue with many of the fundamental propositions in conventional or mainstream economic theory. I think, you know, one of the most common reactions that I have heard to my book, even from economists, is this turns everything on its head. So I think it's fair to say that MMT challenges the conventional mainstream approach to macroeconomic theory. There can be some areas of agreement, but there are very big and important areas of disagreement. And so in that way, if you are a mainstream economist who does not want your views challenged, you might well look at me or other MMT economists and say, you know, point your finger and say heretic or other pejoratives. But I think that, you know, I don't try to get too bogged down in the labels and that sort of thing. I was just always hoping from the earliest stages of my involvement in this project to get the best understanding possible of the monetary system, of the financial system, of the way government finance works. I just wanted to understand it. I didn't really care what label ended up getting attached to it. I just wanted to have a clear and accurate understanding of the economics and the finance.
So that's a great starter, because you say the a clear understanding of the economics. And in I'm an engineer by training, and my job is effectively to come up with reasonable analogies for the layperson to understand how computers work. And my entire life, I was told that a balanced budget is good, and we should run the government like a business. And we always drew a direct line between the home economics courses that I learned about how to budget my household. And then we drew a direct line to civics class, and we talked about how we should have government managed with the same responsibility. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that, the book theorizes.
Right. That's exactly right. And in fact, it's the starting point for the book. The first chapter of the book is called Don't Think of a Household. So it does exactly what you just laid out. It tells us to not draw that straight line from the home economics class to the civics class, to break that thinking and to recognize what distinguishes the federal government's spending capacity from the rest of us, from that of a household or even a private business or even a state and local government. We try to get people right up front to recognize that there is something fundamentally different about the federal government of the United States of America, let's say, and everybody else, in that the federal government is the issuer of our currency, the U.S. dollar. In fact, it has the sole legal authority to issue the currency. The rest of us can't do that. And so once you recognize that, you recognize the spending capacity must be different for the currency issuer compared to everybody else. If I could issue the dollar, I wouldn't worry about ever having bills coming due that I was going to have trouble paying. I wouldn't worry about, you know, being forced into bankruptcy, medical, you know, can I afford to see a doctor? None of those would be concerns for me. But I'm a currency user. I don't get to issue the currency. I face real constraints. I have a real budget constraint that forces me to have to find the money in order to be able to spend dollars. The federal government is different.
So as a household, as a currency user, I have finite resources. My resources are my time, my assets, the physical things that I have around me, and then the currency that I have. Does not the government and the country itself have some limitations? I mean, they have the ability to print money, but the gross domestic product is a finite and measurable thing, and we have only so many rocks and so much silicon that is trapped in mountains. Where are the constraints in a system where you can print money?
Right. And that is the critical question. And unfortunately, it's not where we tend to put our focus. We tend to get bogged down into thinking about, you know, how is the government going to afford this? Where will it find the money? And so once we clear through the fog and we recognize that finding the money is the easy part, spending the money in a responsible way that doesn't push the boundaries, that pays attention to the limits, that's the challenge. So you are exactly right. The federal government is the issuer of the currency. It is not financially constrained, but there are constraints. So what are those constraints? And you listed a number of things. There are our real resources. The government can't hire more people than there are people willing to work for the government. The government can't buy more aircraft carriers.
Right. They're not making any more land.
Yeah. I mean, right. So there are raw materials, there are human resources, labor, and there are, you know, goods and services that are being produced by the economy each year. And at any point in time, the economy is only capable of satisfying so much demand. So we are putting a strain on our economy when we ask the economy to produce more for us. So when we want to increase spending, we're asking the economy to produce something extra so that we can have it. And the government has to share that space. the, mm-hmm. the space in the economy with all the other spenders. So consumers do most of the spending in our economy. They do about 70% of all of the spending normally. Businesses also spend. The rest of the world also buys some goods and services from us. The government has to share the economy's spending capacity with all of those other spenders. So it's really total spending that matters. It's not just government spending, which is a relatively small part of the total amount of spending our economy has to handle. But the government could increase its own spending and push the total beyond the economy's productive capacity. And the punishment for that would be some rising prices. You would see inflationary pressures.
I know that the country of Zimbabwe appeared once in the book, as well as others in similar situations. And my wife is Zimbabwean, and I personally was in Zimbabwe and ended up burying my father-in-law by paying for his funeral and the coffin with a wheelbarrow full of trillions and trillions of dollars, and the dollars were Zimbabwean dollars that were actually printed on just one side because it was not worth their time to print on the other side of the paper. They printed their own money, but their situation is different than ours. Why?
Well, Zimbabwe experienced a hyperinflationary episode. They can happen, and they have happened. You know, it's surprising maybe in some respects how few instances of hyperinflation there have been mm-hmm. in the history of the world. There haven't been all that many, about 60 total since, you know, the beginning of time. But what happened in Zimbabwe, look, I'm not an expert, but as I understand the situation in Zimbabwe, what happened is that Robert Mugabe came to power. Land, it's an agricultural economy. Land was taken from the whites who had been farming the land. And in an effort to reward the freedom fighters, which one could understand, he redistributed land to blacks who had, let's say, no experience farming the land. And you ended up with food shortages, massive, food shortages, had to import food from other countries in order to feed the population. Yes, mm-hmm. the government was printing money, but you have this, confluence of events where you simultaneously have a collapse in the supply side of the economy, the productive capacity, right? And so a guy like Milton Friedman, you know, the Chicago School economist who famously quipped that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. He said that he described it as too much money chasing too few goods. I think a lot of us tend to believe that inflation happens because of the too much money part. And most of the time, when you get these hyperinflationary episodes, like what happened in Zimbabwe or even Weimar Germany, what you have is the too few goods thing happening, that there is something that happens on the supply side of the economy that undermines the productive capacity to produce the goods and services. And that gives rise to accelerating inflation.
That I appreciate that you brought that up, and I didn't mean to sideswipe you with the Zimbabwe thing, but I was drawing a parallel because you just answered my next question, which was, I thought that inflation happens when you start diluting the value of money, and a way to dilute it is to add more into the system. And I was drawing a parallel in my mind of like a company that adds more stock shares. They just pick stock out of thin air, and now there's more shares, which dilutes the available stuff. But now I'm realizing from what you said before that, well, that stock person can believe that their stock is a currency, but it's not. They just tried to invent something out of thin air and print money, but they didn't. They are, in fact, also a consumer of currency. So the parallel to the government versus, you know, printing stock certificates doesn't work either.
Yeah, inflation is such a complex phenomenon. It's a dynamic process. When economists talk about inflation, they're talking about a continuous rise in the price level. Well, what does that mean? You can't just look out the window and see the price level. So we have to build these indices, right? And so we put a bunch of goods and services into a thing we call a basket of consumer goods. Then we weight those items. Then we track the movement of prices of healthcare and housing and energy and all the other things that go into of the basket over time. And then we say, well, that basket is becoming more expensive or less expensive over time. And, you know, obviously you can have headline inflation that is totally uncorrelated with any increase or movement in the money supply. It doesn't have anything to do with diluting the value of the currency by printing up more. You just say, you know, people with pricing power, like pharmaceutical companies, health insurance companies, raise premiums and prescription drug prices, and healthcare costs accelerate, and that feeds into headline inflation, and you say, oh, well, there's inflation, or the government could decide to pay more for the same things and redefine the currency down. And so that would be another way that, you know, we could talk about the impact of government spending on inflation.
Yeah. And your point about the supply side in Zimbabwe, I was there and I lived it. And that's exactly what happened. The inflation was driven by there was no stuff. The cupboard was bare. No one wants to manage databases if they can avoid it. And that's why MongoDB made MongoDB Atlas, a global cloud database service that runs on AWS, GCP, and Azure. You can deploy a fully managed MongoDB database in minutes with just a few clicks or a few API calls. MongoDB Atlas automates deployment, automates updates, handles scaling, and more so that you can focus on your application instead of taking care of your database. You can get started free at mongodb.com/atlas. Now, if you're already managing a MongoDB deployment, Atlas has a live migration service, so you can migrate it easily with minimal downtime and then get back to what matters. Stop managing your database and start using MongoDB Atlas. Shifting to the psychological aspect of this, all my life I was told that the debt clock that's in Times Square was scary, and I saw that there was a section in the book where you were working on the budget committee, and one of the senators felt that there were not enough zeros when describing a trillion, which is like a million, million. So they wanted to actually print out all the zeros. It seemed like I could understand empathetically why that senator, as a former business owner, wanted to see a quote unquote reality. But are those zeros and commas necessary when trying to have a psychological reaction to a number like a trillion?
Well, they're not necessary, but they were, I guess, from his perspective, they were necessary because they were going to help him achieve a particular goal, which was to get people more excited, more agitated about the size of the national debt and the deficit. So instead of having, you know, I was talking in the book about the Congressional Budget Office, which puts out annually these long-term budget outlooks. And so they look into the future and project how much debt the U.S. government will have issued, you know, 10 years, 40 years, 75 years from now. What is the debt to GDP ratio going to be, and all this sort of thing. And if they're putting out numbers and projections that say, well, the debt's going to go from 23 trillion to 26 to 34 to 47, he didn't want them to write 23.7. He didn't want them to write 43.1. He wanted them to write 43,000,000, because he thought that that would stir people and agitate people more, you know, to see all those zero, that string of zeros, because, you know, make it clear what a big number this is. Just assuming that you could tap into their anxieties about public debt if you write the number out in long form. It was very bizarre, actually.
Yeah, it seems like a weaponizing of zeros and commas.
It's exactly what it is. That is exactly what the objective would have been there.
So I've always had a sense of what balanced budget means to me. My budget, we think in the house here, is balanced, but my scale is entirely different than the government's scale. So you indicate that we should not be comparing debt and the national debt and putting that on one side of the scale. What is the correct scale for a healthy country look like?
Yeah, that's right. So I would love to see the narrative shift away from an obsession about trying to achieve a balanced budget. You know, every time the White House annually submits a budget to Congress, and the White House always submits a budget that will balance over a 10-year horizon. They say, well, by the time we get to the end of the 10th year, the government will be matching the amount of money it's spending with the amount of money that it's taking in, as if that's the right goal for public policy. So I would like to see us stop trying to force the budget into balance and for us to start recognizing all of the various, you know, deficiencies and deficits in our real economy and to work hard to rebalance our economy so that we're achieving a broadly balanced economy. So what would that look like? Well, let's start with the most important goals of economic policy. And they are the goals that we have given to the Federal Reserve, that Congress has told the Fed, this is what a good economy looks like. It has high levels of employment and low levels of inflation. I think those are good goals. Let's aim for full employment and relative price stability, right? Low and stable inflation. Those are good goals, but I would go further, right? I think that we should also attempt to achieve a better balance in terms of the distribution of wealth and income in the economy. Right now, we have extreme imbalances. We have allowed the distribution of income and wealth to widen to levels not seen since, you know, the Robert Barron era, the pre-Great Depression in the 1920s. It's too much inequality. The Federal Reserve will tell you that. Many on Wall Street will tell you that once we allow inequality to become this extreme, that it actually is bad for the way our economy works, never mind that it becomes corrosive to democracy, because all of that financial concentration of wealth gives people too much influence over the political process, right? So I think that we need to think about how we want to rebalance the economy, climate, right? How, what does a balanced economy look like? And use the budget as the tool to achieve those broad goals. And if the budget has to be unbalanced to generate a balanced economy, then I want to say that the budget outcome is the right one. I want to call it a balanced budget, even if taxes and spending don't equal one another.
Is there a fundamental disconnect about like what we want to do? Like, I'm the president of our HOA, and everyone said that they wanted a basketball hoop, you know, at the park down the street. And then a small but loud minority thought that that basketball hoop was a bad idea because they weren't kids and they weren't interested in that. And, you know, this whole thing fell apart because of the way our rules work, that we needed their votes, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, there's no basketball hoop, but we found some money for some other stuff that everyone agreed on. It seems like there's always money for, you know, we never said we have no budget for this war, or we've never had no budget for that. We just did the big COVID-19 bailout. But I didn't see one go for schools. Without being political, and again, I'm not trying to say I'm on one side or the other, it seems like a fundamental disagreement about what we want to spend our money on, because we seem to be able to find it for some things but not others.
Well, you're right. I mean, Congress is there, at least in theory, to act as representatives of the voters who elect them into these positions. And while they're there, it seems to me that they should be working hard to deliver on an agenda, right, to set priorities, because we can't have everything. We do have to prioritize. There are limits. So when Congress decides whether to, you know, members of Congress decide whether to vote for this piece of legislation, the equivalent to the basketball hoops, or that piece of legislation, the equivalent of, you know, some extra lighting in the neighborhood or whatever, it ought to reflect the sentiments, the broad sentiments of the majority. It's a democracy. So in the same way, I had an HOA before I moved to New York. We lived in that a neighborhood like that, and we had to do the same sort of thing. We had a swimming pool. We would have conversations about whether to, you know, put more seating and spend more money, or to do, you know, curb work or extra lights or whatever the case may be. And if the votes weren't there, then we didn't get that thing, but we got the thing that had broader popular support. And it seems to me that's a reasonable way to go about allocating resources when you are faced with constraints, and, you know, you allow the people to sort of weigh in, and that helps shape the priorities.
Mm-hmm. It seems like when we talked about that term of weaponizing the commas and the zeros, words get weaponized, like socialism, like national debt. And it seems like a fundamental disagreement about what countries should spend their money on. But MMT like is really popular in smaller countries like Finland because it seems like they've decided what they want to spend their money on. Like, I know we were all promised high-speed trains between LA and New York and, you know, things like that, big build a railroad across the country type stuff. It seems like those only happen in wartime in the US, but smaller countries are able to pull this off. Is this a size issue? Like, are we too big for MMT to work?
Well, no. I mean, I think MMT works everywhere because it's a descriptive framework. So I can use it, you know, I say in the book over and over again, MMT is a lens. MMT is about giving us a better, clearer picture of where the limits lie, of how the monetary system works. Mm-hmm. And once you figure out which country you're analyzing, are you analyzing a country that operates with a sovereign currency like the US, Japan, the UK, Australia, Canada? Are you analyzing a country that doesn't have a sovereign currency, a country like one of the countries that uses the euro? Right? Are you looking at a country like that? Are you looking at a country like Ecuador or Panama that have adopted another country's currency as its own? Those countries don't have the spending capacity that a country like the US or Canada or Australia does. So MMT works no matter where we apply it. It's just that we're helping to explain why the policy space is larger in some countries and diminished in others by virtue of decisions that governments have made to borrow in foreign currency, fix their exchange rates, or whatever. So we could, in the U.S., in spite of being a very large and geographically spread out and diverse population, we could commit to high-speed rail or, universal health care, things that European countries and every, other major country have done. We just have not made those choices.
I see. And there's a concern that we owe our debts in U.S. dollars, but we don't necessarily need to worry about a fiscal crisis because the people that hold those things are really holding, they're holding bonds in a form of those debt. Like China, we're not using China's credit card. They're using our money.
That's exactly right. China decided, and many other countries do as well, that part of their growth strategy was to manufacture things, to produce things for the rest of the world, and in particular for the U.S. So if you want to put your people into factories and have them work all day producing things that get boxed up, loaded onto containers, and then shipped to others to enjoy, to consume, in exchange for that, you receive a payment. You get US dollars. That's our currency. So basically, you get a credit to your checking account at the Federal Reserve. China has an account at the Fed. So we take their stuff. I say take. Okay. We purchase their stuff. And then they get a credit to their account at the Fed. China can do what anyone else with US dollars can do. They can turn those dollars in and get government bonds instead. And so when they do that, they're holding what's effectively an interest-bearing form of US currency. That's a government bond. And those bonds have maturity dates, right? It's a 10-year bond, it's a 30-year bond, whatever. When the bond matures, it converts back into its original form, converts back into the dollar. So to pay back China, all we're talking about is shifting the dollars that are in China's securities account at the Fed, basically a savings account, back into their checking account. And it's no more complicated than that, just shifting dollars from one form of holding to another form of holding.
So as we get towards the end, when I think about the word macro in the context of macroeconomics, I used to think about it in terms of, you know, the big picture worldwide, but I wonder how does time fit into that? What does this look like in 100 years? Because there's a lot of historical comparisons to unemployment and depressions, multiple depressions over the last couple of 100 years, but isn't the information economy fundamentally different? The unknown of what, 2100 looks like or 200 years in the future, will we be coming up with words for numbers that are too big. Like, can quadrillion be a national debt in 100 years, and that's okay?
Well, it already is in Japan.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So in yen, because, you know, that's their unit of account. Sure. So if you said to the Japanese central bank or the finance minister, you know, how large is the Japanese government debt? You would hear the word quadrillion. So, sure. I mean, if we stretch out into a far enough time horizon and Congress is still committed to coordinating its spending, its deficit spending, by selling bonds, then that stockpile of treasuries can grow over time. And notice that I said, if Congress is still committed to selling bonds, because it doesn't have to. The U.S. government, because it's the issuer of the dollar, never has to borrow its own currency from anyone in order to spend. We don't have to go to China. The government doesn't have to go to people who have dollars and say, could we take those back from you and replace it with a bond because we really need the dollars? That's, you're the issuer of the dollar. So at any point in time, the, you know, U.S. government could decide, if it wanted to take away the option to hold your dollars in interest-bearing form. Say, we're not going to sell you treasuries any longer because it makes people too anxious and it leads to too much confusion. We've decided it's not worth the trouble. It mostly provides a subsidy to wealthy investors who like to park their dollars in a safe, risk-free, interest-bearing security called a U.S. Treasury. We're not convinced that serves the public purpose to provide hundreds of billions of dollars of interest income payments every year. So we're just going to stop doing it. And then the answer to your question looking forward would be that we would have retired the national debt. It would go away.
It's interesting because as you're saying this, like going back on the 40 plus years of what I'm taught, I'm like, well, that's unthinkable. Like, no, how would they ever do that? But then I remember in the book, you pointed out that until the early 70s, when Nixon changed things, you know, for every dollar, there was a piece of gold that I could go and pick up and convert and say, here's my dollar. I want my gold. And that chain was broken as well. So these unprecedented things have precedent, don't they?
Yeah, the government can always change the legal rules, the institutions, the responsibilities that rest with the Fed versus Congress or Treasury. All of that is, you know, those are all decisions taken by a legislative body. And we write and rewrite laws all the time. So, yeah, the future could look very different from what we were both trained, frankly, to understand about how this all works.
Well, I really appreciate you chatting with me today. I've only made it about a quarter of the way through the extensive notes and highlights that I took. But I appreciate your bringing this this somewhat heady theory to the people. My last question, I guess, would be, what should I as a layperson, as a consumer, as a user of currency, do with information in a book like this?
Oh, boy. I mean, I hoped and hope now that what the book does is kind of level the playing field so that we're empowering readers to participate in different ways in the public debate so that, you know, I have this image in my mind because I've seen it in action where a member of Congress comes back to his or her home district and goes before constituents in a town hall sort of setting to answer questions and be held accountable. And, you know, their constituents say, hey, it has been 10 years or whatever. We've been looking for some infrastructure investment. You know, what is going on that you guys can't come together and pass an infrastructure bill or whatever it is, right? They ask for. And their lawmaker says, listen, I completely agree with you. I sympathize. I wish we could put more money into education or healthcare or infrastructure or whatever, but it's this deficit, right? There's no money for this stuff. That's where I hope the book becomes important and powerful to average people so that they can push back on that and say that excuse isn't going to fly. Not any longer. We know that Congress can always fund its priorities in the same way that you funded the tax cuts, in the same way you do defense, in the same way we're doing coronavirus right now. We've always had the power to do this. You just have to make a commitment and deem it a priority and then fund it. And as long as the economy has the capacity to safely absorb that spending. You don't even have to go around looking for tax increases and all the rest of it. There's some low-hanging fruit there, so go get it done.
Fantastic. The book is The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy by Dr. Stephanie Kelton. Thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.